This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. No matter what your financial situation is, I'm guessing you feel like you could use some help sometimes, figuring out how to budget, how to save, how to do the right things so that you'll be able to afford your car, your house, your retirement, maybe your kids' college educations. But it's often easier for people with more comfortable incomes to find a financial advisor. People with low or moderate incomes would struggle to find someone willing to take on their situation and probably don't have the disposable cash to pay what a typical traditional financial advisor would cost. That's where someone like Liz Scharf comes in. She's a financial coach with Capstone Community Action. Her organization works in three counties to help Vermonters meet their basic needs and gain stability in their lives. It also helps empower people to take control and to meet their goals. So Liz Scharf helps where money comes in. And let's be honest, money plays a role in almost every facet of our lives. Today on the program, we're going to look at some of the ways Liz helps people think about budgeting, saving, building good credit, or repairing bad, and how she figures out ways to do that no matter what kind of money you're making. Liz Scharf, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much, Jane. I'm really happy to be here.
So what does it actually mean when you do financial coaching? I'm picturing, you know, big pep talk, bullhorn, rah-rah.
There's a little bit of that. What we do as financial coaches is that we work one-on-one with clients to help them establish goals and to actually create action plans. So over the course of time that I would meet with a client, we would talk about their overall financial picture and then come up with some plans that over the week or two that we're not seeing each other that the client can work on and then come back and report to me.
So this is not a one and done. This is a long-term relationship you have with people.
It can be, yeah. On average, I would say they go about four visits with a client, and sometimes it can go on for months. So,
can you give me, just so we get a sense of what we're talking about here, a hypothetical person that you might work with? Give me a situation, the kind of typical situation that people come to you with.
Sure. So someone might have gone to our website and decided that they wanted to get a better feeling for and feeling like they need a financial checkup. So they will come to me, we'll make an appointment, and we'll really just, it might be someone who's making in the low 20s. For example, they might have two part-time jobs. They might not have a retirement account, or they might not even have any credit. And so they'll come and we'll sit down and we'll really talk about what their goals are. Are their goals, what are their long-term goals? Is it home ownership? Is it saving for college? Or what are their short-term goals, such as wanting to build credit? So we spend time talking about that and then setting small measurable goals that they can meet over time that we meet.
Like what? What would a small measurable goal be?
So, for example, I just met with a client recently who did not have a retirement account, nor did he have one available at his workplace. So we offer the option for the client to open a MIRA account, which is a treasury-backed U.S. savings retirement account that has no fees, no minimum balances, no required deposits, and got him – he went ahead and set that up and talked with his workplace about having some direct deposit being put to that account so that he could start a retirement account.
When you talk about something like a retirement account, I mean, we hear all the time how crucial that is for no matter when you want to retire, to be able to have some money coming in the event that you can't work anymore or that you want to stop working, which, you know, people of all walks of life do sometimes want to stop working. But, you know, I can imagine for many people, low income, moderate income, middle class as well, feeling like I don't have the money to do that. So I imagine you get some pushback when you start to say to somebody who's making 20 or 30 grand a year, you need to start paying for retirement.
I definitely do. But the way that I approach it is I explain to them that we're paying Social Security and we're paying for Medicare. And it's important that to know that that isn't going to be enough by the time they reach retirement. And so taking a portion of your paycheck to put towards retirement, and if you do have if you do have a plan at your workplace, it is super crucial to be giving the percentage that they're going to match and staying at the job long enough so that you can keep the match. And if people aren't doing that, they're literally giving away free money. And so it's really starting a habit. And I really encourage young people, especially people right out of college or right out of high school, with their first job to start saving for retirement. Because truly, if they were to continue and put 5 to 10% every year until the retirement, they can be millionaires. And it sounds like a lot of money now, but in 40 years, $1 million isn't what it's going to be today.
And can you really find a way to save that money even with somebody on a very, very tight budget? Because, you know, $50 to one person may be doable and $50 to another could be a really big hurdle.
Yes. So part of what we do when we meet with our clients is to develop a budget and to really see where their money is going every month. And if you don't have a clear picture of the money in, money out, it's not going to be attainable for you to envision a future where you have retirement. So by looking and actually writing down and seeing where your money's going every month, you can see, wow, you know, maybe I do spend a lot of money on restaurants, or yeah, maybe it's time for me to kick that smoking habit. And that will allow people to see that they may have a place to cut back. That being said, Jane, yes, definitely there are people who really are living and struggling paycheck to paycheck, and it's hard. But if you get into the habit of having that money pulled out every paycheck for the rest of your life, you're not going to miss it the way you think you might miss it.
You mentioned restaurants or cigarettes. What else are people surprised about when you actually make a budget and they see what they're spending?
I would have to say the biggest thing is groceries. People have no idea how much they spend on groceries. And someone will say to me, oh, I spend $400 a month. And I say, wow, really? That's great. But when they sit down and actually record and write down what they spend, they come back and they say, wow, I really spent more than I thought I did.
Like, so I was spending $700 a month or
yes,
something?
Yes, exactly. Hundreds more than they think they're spending.
We're talking today about financial advising, financial coaching, and some of the key tools that can help people of all incomes be better about budgeting and saving. And we're talking with financial coach Liz Scharf about the specific challenges people with low and moderate incomes face that may be a little bit different from what the more financially comfortable deal with. That's the kind of clientele she works with often at Capstone Community Action. And listen, if you have a question for her, we all have budgeting questions. She'll do her best to answer them. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions and comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a question from Paul who says, on the subject of identity theft, are the identity and credit monitoring services worthwhile, or are they just letting you know after the fact that your credit report has suspicious activity? Helpful, perhaps, but has the horse already left the barn? Liz, what do you think?
That's a good question. There are fee-for-services out there to monitor your credit reports. I personally don't recommend that people pay for that because you have the option of going every year, up to 3 times per year, to review your own credit report through annualcreditreport.com. And that will allow you to pull your credit report from the 3 major bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, and you can spread them out over the 3 years. And furthermore, generally, if something does happen, your credit card company generally will get in touch with you right away. And if there's been a real breach, they often offer that service for a year. But I probably wouldn't use my money to have that added feature.
How big a deal is credit history and whether you have good credit or bad credit?
Oh, Jane, it's a huge deal. So the cost of credit for someone who doesn't have a healthy credit score. So the credit scores basically range from the low 300s to 850. And anyone 700 and above is generally going to have the ability to borrow at a healthy interest rate. The average in this country is about 680. So that's considered a fair score. It's not great, but you can get some loans. Anything below like 640 is considered subprime. And that's where, you know, you may be able to get a car loan, but you're going to be paying twice the amount or 3 times the amount of interest that someone else is. And over the cost of a lifetime, Jane, you can pay upwards of $100,000 or more if you have poor credit as opposed to someone who's got great credit.
So then what are the barriers to keeping good credit, or what are the pitfalls that people find themselves tripping into that leads them to have bad credit in the first place? Because most of us want to pay the least we possibly have to for big purchases that we use credit cards for.
Right. So there are two very important things that you can do to keep your credit score strong. The first one is paying your bills on time. And that really is, you know, if you have a day late payment, that's not considered a mark against your credit score. It's when you're 30 days or more late. And also staying within your debt to available credit ratio. So, for example, if you had a credit limit of $2,000 on your credit card, you wouldn't want to spend more than about 20% of that to keep a healthy score. And you'd want to pay it in full to avoid interest rates. So if you had a $2,000 limit, you really would want to keep your purchases at around $200 per month and pay it in full.
Okay, Liz, but let me ask you a really practical question. If I'm somebody who I'm looking at my bills for this month and I have four bills that I need to pay and I know I don't have the cash to pay them all. So one is a credit card bill, one is a utility bill, and I certainly don't want my utilities shut off, but I also don't want to have a ding on my credit. One is a medical bill. Which one do I leave on the table?
So that's another great question, Jane. So I would definitely pay your credit card bill and at least pay the minimum. And that's really to avoid having a mark against you on your credit report. Medical bills, if it's coming from the hospital, what you want to do if you're having trouble paying your medical bill is to make a call to the billing office and set up a payment plan. It takes a while for medical bills from hospitals to actually go to collections because they don't want to send it to collections any more than you want it sent to collections. And they're willing to work with you to work out a payment plan. And in some cases, they, for really low income at poverty or below, they may have some forgiveness programs or grant programs that can help pay for bills. So in the situation that you just said, I would definitely pay your credit card bill. And I would also talk to your utility company and see if there's a date, maybe you're not getting paid till next week, and you can call them and say, listen, I want to make this payment, but times are tough this month. Can I pay it in 2 weeks?
And that can work. I mean, I can imagine myself thinking, maybe if I just pretend like I forgot and I pay it in a couple weeks, that's better than actually talking to people.
Well, it's really important to make those phone calls, especially to a credit card company. If you're having trouble and you're not even able to make the minimum, it doesn't mean that you're not going to pay interest, but they have some programs that can halt your payment for a month so that you can get back on track.
Liz, you sometimes work with people who don't have any income coming in. How do you help them work on financial situations that might arise in the future that aren't even available to them now, that they're homeless and don't have a job or are just coming out of prison or are in a situation where they haven't been working, so there's no income, but they still want to make sure that they're getting themselves in a good position?
Right. So in those circumstances, it's difficult. What I tend to do is sit down with them and talk about what their expenses are. And a really important item that I want to note is that even if you don't have enough money to pay all your bills each month, it's really important to know where your money is going. And so for the people that don't have jobs, they still are going to have food. They're still going to have shelter. And they may be getting some of these in the form of assistance or subsidies, but they need to know right off the bat what they're looking at as far as, so when I get a job, this is how much money I'm going to need to make. And when I get a job, this is where my credit is, and this is how I can build my credit. And so that's what I talk about. And I often say to people, listen, when you get your job, call me because we can talk about the next steps that we need to take to get your budget up and running and to get you building your credit.
What about people who are listening who say, okay, but I'm making enough to pay my bills and I feel like I've got that sort of sorted out, but I'd love to save to buy an apartment or buy a house, or I know I'm going to need a new car and you know, I'm not quite in this category of people that you're talking about. Do you see all kinds of clients from all walks of life?
Yes, I do. In fact, a lot of my clients make, you know, very good salaries, and they're in the same position as someone who may be not making a lot of money. And that is that they may have a lot of student loan debt. They may have a lot of credit card debt because they may have had to borrow at some point in their life when they didn't have the salaries that they have now. And so what we do is we work together on looking at the overall picture and deciding, okay, this is what they have for credit card debt. This is what they have for student loan debt. How is it that we can look at these numbers, maybe do some consolidation if necessary, or make some extra payments so that those balances go down so that you're in a better position in a year or two to be able to set that money aside to save? And so that's exactly what I'll do with people is look at their interest rates and see, is there a way that we can increase the payments on these credit cards so that you're not just paying the minimum and taking 17 years to pay it off because you're only paying the minimum, so that in 3 years you're done and you can start saving that money for a goal.
And you're not the only financial coach who does this kind of work for a nonprofit in the state. This is a statewide program.
This is a statewide program, and they originate from the community action programs in Vermont. So there are five community action agencies. We have been doing this for really since, you know, the crisis in 2008, the economic downturn. We were beginning to see more people and do some financial coaching and budgeting with people and helping them build credit at the various agencies that we have. And most recently, we just received a really generous grant from the Northfield Savings Bank Foundation, which has allowed us to hire some additional coaches in our Burlington, Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity and Capstone. And that's enabled us to hire additional coaches to build the momentum of improving financial literacy in Vermonters.
And it's free for Vermonters?
It's free for Vermonters. There are income guidelines, but in general, honestly, I don't – if someone needs to come and talk about the fact that they are having difficulty saving for a house because their student loans are too high, I'm not going to turn people away. And people have said, like, oh, wow, this is free. And I say, you know, if you can make a donation to one of the programs, that would be great. But we don't have a fee-for-service for the coaching. We do have a fee-for-service for financial education classes. So if we are going into a business, for example, and the business is offering it as a employee benefit, then we have a modest charge for doing that.
To the business.
To the business, yep.
We're talking today about financial coaching. We're looking at ways to budget, some of the key ways to gain financial independence and security, and to keep it if you're already financially independent, but worry about things like student loans, retirement, buying a house, buying a new car. How do you do all of that? How do you keep good credit or repair bad credit? We're talking with Liz Scharf, and she works for Capstone Community Action in Barrie. Coming up, we'll talk with one of the clients Liz Scharf works with to find out how financial advising has helped in her life, and we'll take your calls and emails. If you have a question about your own budget or about budgeting in general, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Liz Scharf about the work she does as a financial coach. She works with all kinds of people, but the organization she works for, Capstone Community Action, has a mission of helping Vermonters gain independence and financial stability. So her focus is on people who are low and moderate income and may struggle to save, to budget, and to make ends meet. If you have a question for her about your own situation or about the role of financial coaches, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And we also wanted to invite someone who is in that kind of position to join us as well. On the line with me now is Stephanie, who has worked with Liz Scharf to get her financial house in order. Stephanie asked that we only use her first name since, you know, talking about financial problems and issues can negatively affect your ability to get or maintain a job, housing, lots of other things. Stephanie, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell me why you wanted to see a financial coach like Liz in the first place?
Sure. My partner and I decided to join houses, and budget was our main focus on two people with different backgrounds and moving into one household and trying to figure out how to blend big family and looking for short and long-term plans. So that was my initial reason for contacting Liz through Capstone.
So how does the coaching help you?
It helped us in numerous ways. We've met with her on a regular basis. We've gone over a budget online. We've checked in with email and in person, and we've revised. And Liz helps us come up with a realistic plan, something that we look at short-term and long-term. And it helps us look at our money habits, you know, and our debt and retirement.
Was there anything, Stephanie, that surprised you when you looked at your budgets or looked at trying to combine these two lives and two financial histories?
Well, money personalities come a lot into it and how we each spend. And I heard Liz earlier say groceries. So, yeah, it was a big sort of shock to us on how much we spend on those extra things that fly out the door that you don't keep track of. So Liz has helped us, you know, helped us together as a couple, but we've also been working with her singly, you know, separately we meet with her. So it's helped us in that on keeping track of where our money goes to so we can look at our short and long-term goals. So that was the biggest shocker, was how much we spend on stuff that we don't plan for.
When you say different money personalities, tell me more about that.
So we have a saver and a spender and, you know, two people that have been, you know, single parenting for a while that come together. And I look at long-term goals and he looks at, you know, right now in the moment and trying to figure out where we both want to be. And he likes to save and I like to spend for the moment. So that took Liz a little bit of revising us to figure out what, you know, how we do our budgets, and we set aside envelopes on how much we can spend on our meals as opposed to, well, we'll just catch up with later. So that's been sort of invaluable for us as a couple and, you know, as us individually on looking at our spending.
Liz told me before we got started, she said something about financial counseling, and then she said, don't use the word counseling because I'm not a counselor. It's not like marriage counseling.
She is kind of a counselor.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say to you.
Is.
It sounds, Stephanie, like, you know, yeah. In order to make your relationship work and to meet your financial goals,
yeah.
This is sort of counseling.
Yeah, and we're meeting her tonight, as a matter of fact. So it has been, because we, you know, you have different backgrounds, and, you know, and I've gone to a 5-week class separate from, you know, meeting with Andy. And so I've come home after every week with more information. So, yeah, I'm always talking about this. And I see her on an individual basis. So it has helped our relationship because money is, you know, it's really instrumental in our day-to-day. And it was great that Liz helped us look at what our long-term goals were and how we could get there and how we needed to change our credit scores if we needed to, and so, yeah, she's a wealth of knowledge.
Well, I was going to ask you about those long-term goals, Stephanie, and what tangible things will let you know that you're in a better position or that you're doing things better than you were before you got some financial education?
Well, my credit score has gone up, so that was one tangible thing. And we've started to discuss retirement in 529, so I can see where, you know, instead of money going out for dinner, can go into retirement. And so I'll be able to see that tangibly going up. And we are looking at, like, our home equity loan, when that's paid off, where will that money go? When I'm done paying for my auto loan, how will that money go? So we can look at, you know, I have it mapped out, like, 1 through 8 years, basically till our youngest child gets out of the nest. Where we're going to go. So, and Liz shared a book with us that also helps us keep on track with that, that has us do our every year plan. And we're still revising. You know, Liz gave us a budget that we're still looking at and seeing if it makes sense to us. She wants us to be really realistic to make sure that we're living, you know, within our means, but we're not slighting ourselves, so to speak. That makes
mm-hmm.
sense?
Mm-hmm. So if there are other people who come to you and say, you know, I know what my problems are. It's that I don't make enough money, and I don't have the money to do what I want. I don't need a financial coach. Do you think that's true? I mean, can anybody get a benefit from having somebody who helps
them?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I feel like our biggest benefit is that I have someone that works specifically with us and is personalized to us. And I don't think it matters if you don't have enough money, the money that you do have coming in, if you're not spending it in the right direction. Liz helps guide you in how better ways. I just met with her this week on, I have this little bit of money, and do I put it into this account? Do I pay off that bill? Do I put it into this? And, you know, we kind of sat down and went in all the different avenues. So I don't think it matters how much money you make. I think there are absolute benefits to learning about your credit score and talking about retirement, and my credit report has gotten better already, and, you know, following our personal plans and now our long-term goals.
Well, Stephanie, thank you for sharing your story with us, and congratulations on the goals you've set and the success you've already seen. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Liz.
Bye.
So, Liz, that was almost like an infomercial for you.
Great.
You're blushing over here. We're talking with Liz Scharf. She's a financial coach with Capstone Community Action in Barrie. That's a nonprofit that works with people to get their financial houses in order and to do this kind of long-term planning that Stephanie was talking about to make sure that they can meet their financial goals and have independence. And we have some callers on the line if you'd like to share your question with us or your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211, or post a note at the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Anne is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Anne. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. My abiding question has been why we don't teach children, along with their reading, writing, and arithmetic, about finance, which will be there with them for the rest of their lives as issues. And I'm delighted to hear that you have such a person to go to. But why, you know, and I don't want to put anybody out of business, but why can't we take that information that's there, you know, and impart it to the children who will be using it forever?
Anne, thanks for the call. And, you know, interestingly, we've had some financial education teachers on the show in the past. It sounds like some schools are doing this as a graduation requirement, but certainly not all of them, Liz. And it does seem like something that could be taught. If you're not being taught by your parents, it's something that could be taught at school as a useful life skill.
Most definitely. I believe the state of Vermont recently received something like a D+ on financial literacy in the schools. And there are a handful of schools. My kids' school, U32, is one of them. I know a couple of other schools also require financial literacy as a graduation requirement. That being said, it's very important that the schools do offer those classes and have them as requirements for graduation. But that's not enough. It also has to come from the home and seeing good, healthy habits. And part of the grant that we've received from the Northfield Savings Bank Foundation really is also focusing on what we can teach parents to teach their kids so that we don't have the parents that I might see today. I don't want their children to make the same mistakes and I want their children to have the knowledge to make healthy financial decisions.
But it seems like parents don't always know either, because, you know, when it comes to even something, I can remember when I was starting out, do I get a credit card or not get a credit card? Because I don't want a credit card, but I didn't realize that I should be building up my credit. Then perhaps a credit card would be helpful. But okay, then which one? Do I want to just get a basic one, or do I want to get a mileage card, or do I get one from a store? I mean, there are so many questions, and this moves so quickly that I think even for many parents, it's a new world for their kids that are coming out of school, and they may not know how to advise them, right?
That's definitely true. And I think that even adults that have healthy credit scores right now don't even know necessarily how they got their credit score to be healthy. And they don't know that perhaps if they have a score of something like a 780 today and they make a late payment, that can drop by 100 points if they make a 30-day late payment. And if they're not aware of that and they don't have that knowledge, then, you know, you're right, it isn't something that they can then pass on to their kids. And, you know, that's where we come in the community action agencies, is getting that information out there, and the NSB Foundation supporting us and wanting us to have that outreach to more Vermonters so that we are having a more financially literate state.
Let's go to Royalton and hear from John. Hi, John. Go right ahead. Hi, John. You there?
Oh. Yeah, I'm there. I just want to shut you up. I'm here. I just want to turn my speakerphone off.
All right. That sounds better.
Yeah. I had a when I got my divorce, my credit went down the drain. And what I had to do is just itemize everything, make deals with creditors, and go out and get myself a little Firestone credit card with a $500 limit, and just pay it off, then join the credit union. And the guy, a credit card through the credit union with a $1,000 limit. And that was 1995. It's 2015, and I have an 820 credit score. So you can do it, but you got to really work at it, and you got to pay your bills and don't make minimal payments because it doesn't work.
John, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. You know, John just said you have to do it, and it takes some commitment. And we got a note from Robin who says, I'm a daily money manager. People sometimes contact me to help them with a budget. They know they overspend. I've found that most want me to find them more money, and they're not willing to put in the work to track expenses, reduce spending, and engage in their own budgeting process. So Robin asks, how do you get your clients to commit to the work it requires to budget and stay within the budget?
Well, Robin, you're right. I think that people definitely need to embrace this change. And I cannot convince someone who may be, for example, be mandated to come see me because they are involved in our emergency housing program. And so if they're coming to see me, it's often because they actually do want to make some changes. And I think it really helps to see numbers down on paper, to see what they can possibly achieve. And I use a lot of online tools for example, consolidating debt and just showing the interest rates, or if you made more payments, this is how much you'd be able to save over the course of a lifetime. And seeing real numbers, this often has a really powerful impact on people.
Yeah, it's easier to cheat if you're just assuming you know how much you're
right.
spending on groceries or on
exactly.
chips and things that you probably could save. But
right.
once you see it in front of you, it must be harder to avoid.
Definitely. And, John really has a good point that it takes time to rebuild your credit, so that if you have a poor credit score, really the ultimate goal is to get new, fresh credit that you are paying on. And some people say, well, how can I do that if I have poor credit? And there are several ways to do that. One is to open a credit building loan, and a lot of banks offer low amounts that you can have set in a security deposit, and then you pay towards those each month, and they report it to the credit reporting agencies, and you start to build your credit. Or you can have a secured credit card and use that. But again, keeping in mind that if you're going to do something like a secured credit card, that you really stay within that 20% of your available credit, so that you're not, because your credit score will go down if you start to max out your credit cards.
We got a question from Michelle who says, I started a new business a year and a half ago, and now I've incurred huge personal debt. Should I look at a loan to consolidate my credit card debt?
So if you have good credit, it's definitely worth looking at to see if you can find a lower interest loan that will allow you to have overall lower interest. Some people will, if they have good credit, and again, you have to have a good credit score to do this, oftentimes people will transfer over balances to the 0% interest. That being said, you really have to be careful about reading the fine print to find out, okay, is this 0% for a full year and then I pay interest, or do I pay interest from the time that I transfer it over and I have to have it paid off within a year? So it's definitely worthwhile to look at a consolidation loan.
Boy, that fine print stuff is so hard, though, because it is all written in legalese that seems like it's designed to fool you or to make you not quite understand what you're signing.
Yes, but since 2009 with the Credit Card Act, they've really improved that so that things are more transparent, and it shouldn't be too difficult for you to get that information from the contract.
So is there one key? I mean, Robin mentioned people just want her to find them more money, and I suppose I'm asking you the same question here in a way. But is there one key to sort of thinking about budgeting or thinking about money that can help anybody, no matter what their financial situation, as you move forward and trying to think about the goals that you have and how having the money that you want can help you reach them?
Yeah, I mean, really, it kind of boils down to money in, money out, and living within your means. And there are a couple of things that you can do just to make sure that you're able to pay your bills each month. You may be able to negotiate dates for your payments. You may be able to even negotiate paying twice to your landlord so that your money flow is working for you during the month. But you're right. It's hard to come up with sometimes that extra money.
And there's no magic bullet.
There's no magic bullet.
Darn, Liz, come
work.
On.
I know. I wish there were.
Liz Scharf is a financial coach with Capstone Community Action. Again, that's a nonprofit that works in Washington, Orange, and Lamoille counties to help people gain stability and financial independence. This program that she's a part of, though, with the financial coaching is statewide. Liz, thank you so much for being on the program with us.
Oh, thanks so much, Jane. It was a real pleasure.
Coming up, think about how difficult it would have been for musicians to play music together before modern tuning standards, and for composers to be clear on what their music should sound like. We'll get a historical tutorial later on Timeline. But first, an update on that multi-billion gallon sewage dump in Montreal. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. After months of debate, the city of Montreal began dumping wastewater directly into the St. Lawrence River Tuesday night at midnight. The plan was needed, officials said, in order for some infrastructure projects to be completed, and it had the backing of the Montreal mayor. But it also had many in the city concerned about pollution in the river and the smell that could be produced from the discharges. The discharges ended on Saturday night. Ronald Gehr is a professor of civil engineering at McGill University in Montreal, and he joins us now to discuss the project and how it all went. Professor Gehr, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much.
Why was the direct discharge of wastewater into the St. Lawrence necessary?
There were three projects that they had to complete. First of all, there's a snow chute which had to be moved. Now, the snow chute is a chute into which the trucks that carry snow that has been removed from the streets, this snow is dumped down a chute, which then feeds the snow to the sewage treatment plant. So all the snow that falls on the streets in Montreal is literally carried to these chutes, and then the snow is treated downstream at the treatment plant. Because of construction of a highway, they had to move one of the entry points for those chutes, and that was the first project. Then the second one was to inspect and replace some huge valves. Now the sewer is very, very large. It starts out at about 2.9 meters in diameter, which is almost 10 feet. And at the end of the sewer, it's about 5.5 meters, which is almost 20 feet in diameter. So these are huge valves. The sewer itself was built in the 1980s, and so it's showing its age, and some of these valves had to be checked and certain components replaced. And then the third project was going back to these chutes that I was talking about. When they built the sewer originally, they added points at which new chutes could be connected. This was in anticipation of having additional chutes. However, they were not needed, and some of the entry points were actually deteriorating and were literally falling off. The pieces of wood and concrete were starting to fall off and cause huge problems at the treatment plant. So these had to be repaired. So there were those three projects.
And Professor Gehr, it sounds like there was no feasible way to divert this wastewater to another treatment plant before sending it into the river. So it was going into the river from Tuesday night at midnight until it ended on Saturday.
Correct.
How much different was the effluent going into the river as untreated effluent? How much different was that from the effluent that has been treated at a sewage plant and then goes into the river?
Yes, that's a good question. Our treatment plant is, let me go back one step. There's only one treatment plant, really, for the entire island, serving about 3 million people. So this is why there was no alternative. There was no way to divert the flow to another treatment plant. Okay, so this particular sewer is the Southeastern Interceptor. It's called the Interceptor, which means it collects sewage from outfall pipes that would have discharged into the river directly. And this treats about one-third of the flow, of the total flow. So the two-thirds that were not treated, they were being treated anyway, and that was fine. But even on good days, when treatment occurs normally, there's no removal of, or very little removal of fecal coliforms, which is what I think most people are worried about. There's currently almost no removal. And there's also no removal of ammonia or pharmaceuticals or hormones or endocrine disruptors. And that's because the treatment plant is basically a primary treatment plant with chemical assistance. So what they do remove is phosphorus. And that was the objective to when they designed the plant and built it and operating it. The main objective is to remove phosphorus, because phosphorus is and was considered to be the major pollutant affecting the water quality in the St. Lawrence River.
You know, it's interesting in reading about the tests that have been done since this discharge started and all of the testing for that coliform bacteria and other things that are harmful to human health. It sounds like it's almost no different than a regular week, and certainly no different than when there have been big storms and there are sewage overflows, which we're also very familiar with combined systems here in Vermont. So aside from the phosphorus issue, which I don't mean to just shove aside because that is a big issue, but aside from that, it almost seems like what's the point of having a sewage treatment plant if this multi-billion gallon overflow or dump into the St. Lawrence is almost no different from a regular week?
Yeah. Well, they do remove about 50 or 60% of suspended solids, maybe 70% of suspended solids. Now, suspended solids, these are the particles that we can see, and they can include large particles. You know, I mean, I don't want to go into details here, but
yeah, I think we can all imagine what large particles might be coming from our toilets.
Yeah, exactly. So these are removed. These are very well removed from the, you know, at the treatment plant. It's when I say 60 to 70%, so the remaining 30-40%. These would be the very, very small particles that do not settle out in the settling tanks at the treatment plant.
All right. So I guess the upshot is it may not have done that much or be that different, but at least in a normal treatment system and normal week, the suspended particles are being removed. Professor Gehr, I thank you very much for talking with us about this. It's interesting, and it's interesting to get your perspective.
Okay. You're very welcome.
Ronald Gehr is a professor of civil engineering at McGill University. And again, the city of Montreal was dumping untreated wastewater directly into the St. Lawrence River for nearly a week while doing some maintenance on city infrastructure. Professor Gehr was giving us his perspective on that impact. And now we bring you another installment of Timeline, a series about the people, events, and concepts that shaped Western music heritage. Johann Sebastian Bach's seminal work, The Well-Tempered Clavier, showcases an ability to collaborate that we take for granted in modern music. Today, musicians play with anyone, in any key, thanks to modern standards of tuning. But that wasn't always the case, as VPR Classical host James Stewart explains.
When you hear an orchestra tuning up before a performance, they are tuning to a standard frequency, what we call A440. That's the A above middle C. It must vibrate at exactly 440 cycles per second. But it hasn't always been that way. Some scholars believe that the pitch of Baroque instruments could have been around 415. That's an entire half step lower. But tuning a single note is just the beginning. Figuring out how to tune multiple notes to each other has been the real challenge. The word temperament is used to describe how we tune or create scales, the building blocks of Western music. Today, we utilize a tuning called equal temperament, where the octave is split into 12 equal steps that we call semitones. But history is filled with different ways that a scale could be tuned. In Bach's day, the standard tuning method was called mean tone temperament. The limitations of this system meant that a single keyboard could only play in 5 or 6 related keys. That means that you would have to have multiple keyboards to play in all the available keys. This brings us to Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. That title simply means that a single keyboard is tuned in such a way that the performer can play in all 24 keys, 12 major and 12 minor. We aren't sure if Bach had our modern method of tuning in mind, but he set out to compose a prelude and fugue in every key possible on a single instrument. He did this in 1722, and then again 20 years later, books 1 and 2. In Bach's own words, the Well-Tempered Clavier was composed for the profit and use of musical youth, desirous of learning, and especially for the pastime of those already skilled in this study. These manuscripts were copied and circulated widely throughout Europe, but the work was not officially published until 1801. However, you can certainly hear the influence of the Well-Tempered Clavier in the compositions of the High Classical era. Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven all studied these works very closely. Find out more about Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier and follow the timeline at vpr.net/classical.
That was VPR Classical's James Stewart. There's a wealth of musical education in each short episode of Timeline. It's a series about what shaped Western music, and you would be well advised to podcast the series at vpr.net or on VPR's mobile app. Did you know that there's a Green Bay, Vermont, and a Central Park, and a Satan's Kingdom? Tomorrow we'll be talking about Vermont place names, how some of them came to be, and who's in charge of approving or rejecting new names for mountains, ponds, brooks, and communities. Let us know some of your favorite Vermont place names, post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, and join us tomorrow at noon for more. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.